I want you to tell the story again. I know you told it earlier this week about how you became one of the first American Fokker Wolf 190 pilots. Would you tell us that one?
Well, first of all, compared to our airplanes, it was complicated for me to start. When I was captured, I was installing Luft 1, and that was up on the Baltic Sea. And there were 1,200 people there when I arrived, 10,000 when I left. One of the pilots I had heard was stationed at Wright Field, and that was my dying ambition, was to get a formal education on flight testing. And they had the only school in the world at that time. And it required a written exam equivalent to an engineering degree. Well, I had studied enough to pass that test. And so I made the grade to become a bona fide, legitimate test pilot for experimental testing. And I got friendly with this major, and I got him to tell me about Wright Field and all those things. And finally one day he said, I just had 10 hours in a Fokker Wolf 190, and I was sent to England to fly the captured German airplanes that the British had. And he said, I talked General Kleppner into letting me go on a combat mission. He got shot down the first mission. And his name was Gus Lundquist, and he later became a general. But he spent 7 months in that prison camp, and we'd go out and he'd draw the cockpit layout in the sand for me. And I thought I was retaining everything he told me, and that was not the case. Your mind, if you'd look at that cockpit and everything is in German and you can't read German, I tell you, you've got a problem. Well, the last 2 weeks of War II, and I had attempted escape so many times I can't even remember. So I was going through lots of solitary confinement for my attempts to escape. And I was always encouraged by a colonel who had a death sentence, and every day he didn't know if he'd go before a firing squad the next day. And his name was Russ Spicer, one of my real heroes. And when I would attempt to escape and get caught, they'd put me in different cells for solitary, and I got in the cell next to him, and we could hear the guards go one way and the other. And he kept encouraging me, don't give up, make it so tough for these people. He said, keep doing what you're doing. And I told him, yes, sir, I would, but we'd have to whisper because we'd wait till the guards separated, and you could hear them walking on these wood planks away from us, and that's when you could talk to one another. Well, each time I would get in there and was anywhere near him, we'd continue the same conversation repeatedly. And he ended up being a great hero. I just can't tell you, but it turns out that there were 200 out of 10,000 who got over the fence the last 2 weeks of the war. The Russians were on their way, guards were deserting, and I was the first of those 200 to go over the fence and get out. And there were two others that went with me, a fellow by the name of Jerry Ennis, who's no longer with us, but Jerry said, I don't ever want to fly again. He was from my outfit, and he said, I just want to be with you as we go across Germany. And so he did stay with me the whole way. And after about 2 days of being on walking and being on the countryside, we couldn't find anything to eat. And I said, Jerry, we're going to have to knock on the door of this farmhouse and see if we can get somebody to give us some food. And so I knocked on the door, and this lady answered the door, and I said, do you speak English? And she said, a little bit, but not very much. And so I told her that we'd escaped and we were starving, and could she help us out? and I asked her for a paper and a pen or a pencil, and she gave them to me. And so while she was preparing some eggs and potatoes, I wrote down a message. I said, "To whom it may concern, this lady has helped us in our escape, and please be very kind to her because she has done her best to aid us and treat her with civility." And she didn't read the note. And so we thanked her, shook hands with her, and started down a dirt road. And I heard somebody yell, and I turned and looked back, and this lady was running toward me, and I ran back to her. And she said, "I just read your note in broken English," and she said, "I want you to have this." And she handed me a handgun with cartridges, clips of cartridges, three of them. And she said, "This will do you more good than it will do me when the Russians come through." And so we thanked her profusely, and off we went. Well, now we had something we really needed. So we stole a couple of bicycles and went on our way. And eventually, we were in and out of the Russian lines, which was a whole story in itself. But we got through that and ended up on a deserted airfield. And it was loaded with Focke-Wulf 190s. And most all of them were battle damaged. And I found one that had bullet holes and all over it, but nothing that was vital to flight. And none of them had injured the engine, and they had topped it off with fuel. And I looked at half a dozen of them, and, you know, people ignored me. They were deserting all over the place. And so we had this gun, and I told Jerry before, I said, "I want to get in a Focke-Wulf and get out of here and take it back to our lines." And he said, "I'll help you, but what? I don't see how you're ever going to pull it off." And I said, "Well, some mechanic will walk by here, and when he does, I'm going to put the gun on him and get him in this revetment." Revetment is where they used to build mounds of dirt and then put netting over the top as camouflage, and that's how they could keep from being seen by the reconnaissance aircraft, just a camouflage type thing. And so I got in the cockpit, and I looked at it, and I thought, where do I begin? I just not remembered everything Gus had told me. And I sat there and looked it over, and I said, "Jerry, I've just been fooling myself. I can't get it started, and we've got to wait and get it. When a mechanic walks by here, I'll put the gun on, get him in here, and we'll get him to start it for me." Well, a maintenance guy came along, and I knew by his coveralls that he was a mechanic, and I motioned him in the revetment, and we couldn't communicate. He couldn't speak English. We couldn't speak German. And Jerry said, "You know, Bob, I taught French lessons in high school before joining the service," and he said, "Let me try my French out." He did, and the mechanics did speak French. So now we had the communications we needed. He explained to him that I was going to fly the airplane out, and he was going to have to start it for me. If he didn't, Jerry was going to kill him. Well, this poor guy turned white, I mean just white, and started perspiring. And I couldn't find a cushion or a parachute. And so I got in a cockpit, and I'm just barely looking out over the canopy rails. And he got it started for me, and I didn't want to take a chance of taxiing out to the runway. So I just ran the engine to full power in the revetment and straight out of there. I got airborne, and I knew I was the dumbest pilot that you've ever seen in your life. Here I am in an airplane with swastikas, no parachute, and any second lieutenant in the world could have shot me down. And fortunately, there was a cloud deck at about 4,000 feet, and I went right up to the bottom, the base of the cloud deck, and stayed right there so that if any of our allied airplanes picked me up, I could scoot into the clouds, and they would lose me. And I was now worried about where am I, no charts, no anything, just sense of instinct, that's north. Had a good boat compass, and so I wanted to head west. So I headed north first until I hit the North Sea, and I turned west, and I knew I couldn't land on any airport I would see, any runways, because the Germans would mine them when they would leave a retreat. And we lost a lot of our folks when it landed airfields across Africa because they'd be blown up with landmines when they landed on the runway. So I thought, I can't land anywhere until I see windmills. And so I knew if I saw windmills, I'd be in Holland, and they disliked the Germans as much as we did. And when I saw the windmills, now I can't find a runway. And so all the gauges are just flickering on zero, and I ended up seeing a field that looked pretty level, and I thought, I'm going to put the wheels down and land on that field. Well, I landed, and I can't brag about the landing, but I landed it okay, and all of a sudden I saw a ditch that I had not seen from the air. And I decided, if I hit that ditch, I'm going to be flipped upside down, and I'll be trapped in the airplane. And so I booted full rudder, ground looped it, which wiped out the landing gear. And then I sat there in the cockpit for a few seconds and said, you've got to be the dumbest aviator that ever lived. And I got out of the cockpit, and I had seen a road that went on the other side of some trees. And so I was going to try and get out on that road, hoping that somebody would come along and pick me up. And all of a sudden, people were coming at with pitchforks in the woods there. And they thought I was a German, and they hated them. And I held my hands up and kept pointing on the other side of the trees, and I kept walking with my hands up. And I got to this road, and it was a paved road. And this British truck came along within no amount of time at all, maybe 10 minutes. And I was waving my arms frantically, and I yelled, I'm a Yankee. And he stopped the truck, and I told him, I said, they think I'm a German, and I'm just trying to get back to our lines. And he said, hop in, old chap. And so I got in the front seat with the two of them, and they took me as far as they were going off of the main road, and they're a bit ready to leave the main road, and then I hitchhiked from there. And at any rate, that was how I got out. And it was not the smartest thing anybody could ever have done, but a lot of people thought it was, but I never did.
Bob.